This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.
Hi, this is Mary Grady for AvWeb, and I'm talking with Phil Boyer. He was the president of AOPA at the time of the 9/11 attacks in 2001, and he was one of the real front line point people in dealing with all of the aftermath of that. So we're going to talk a little bit about what happened on that day and going forward over the next 10 years. And Phil, thanks for joining us.
Well, a pleasure to be with you, Mary. Unfortunately, on a subject that's not as friendly to general aviation as most, but we did the best we could. And 10 years later, it's a little bit far back to remember, but it's one of those things at AOPA during my almost two decades that it's hard to forget the advocacy that was required at those troubling times.
That's right, because as you said, it's 10 years ago, so it's starting to become a little bit less immediate in our minds. But all of GA aircraft was grounded, of course, when that happened, and AOPA was instrumental in helping to negotiate how we would get back in the air.
Well, it probably is a great example of an organization like AOPA. Is really essential for pilots, and probably if I were ever do a memoirs, which I'm not even thinking of doing, it would have to go down as one of the highlights of what we did and had to do to maintain some kind of equal footing with all of other aviation. As soon as that afternoon, I was in touch with then Secretary of Transportation Norm Mineta, who, although he wasn't a pilot, certainly understood general aviation, and we had a great personal relationship. I knew his sons. Both of them were pilots, very active in aviation, and he was a very fair-minded politician, both as a local politician, as a national representative, and then, of course, being appointed as Secretary of Transportation. So we began what was almost at least a once or twice a day phone call the afternoon that Tuesday, as he was facing a difficult situation of how do we bring aviation back. And, of course, I was there insisting that, you know, this problem was not one caused by general aviation. And the weapons of destruction were not even anywhere closely related to general aviation airplanes. So it was unfair to penalize us. And obviously we saw slowly the airlines get back into service. I think it was as early as Wednesday evening or Thursday morning. And I kept insisting we get an equal footing. And once again, dealing mainly with the Secretary of Transportation and not the FAA, which, of course, reports to his office. And by Thursday, it appeared that we would get the larger business aircraft on IFR flight plans back in the air. And I think Thursday evening or Thursday afternoon, there was really a false start. Planes were given a time, and then Mineta changed his mind on that. And I remember a couple pilots were stranded in Atlanta in larger, like Gulfstreams, engines fired up and ready to go for the noon deadline that was set so that they could leave, and they had to turn around and come back. But by Friday, we were able to obtain his approval and FAA approval that general aviation airplanes on instrument flight plans, and I'm accepting areas like Washington, D.C., would be able to fly. And I know I flew to Columbus in our company airplane, IFR, and was one of the first flights to give a speech that had been scheduled that Friday night, and was real pleased to be able to fly even under instrument flight rules.
How did you deal with the ongoing ramifications of restrictions on takeoffs and landings in certain places, and were there even more restrictions that were under consideration that maybe were deflected?
Well, there were a lot of considerations. I will tell you that based now on my little story that got us up through Friday night, pretty much after that, we were dealing then not with the Secretary of Transportation, who had a lot of other things on his on his plate, but we were dealing then with the FAA. And the biggest thing was, you know, that's fine for an instrument pilot or business aviation, which are flown by two pilots, all of it under instrument conditions, even if it's VFR weather. But what about the vast majority of general aviation pilots who are flying VFR? And the thing I had to counter the most was that even at the FAA, they had to counter this too, were politicians, security officials, all saying, you mean there are planes out there flying without a flight plan and we have no idea who's flying them or where they are going? And that was probably the most difficult situation to let people know this has been the majority of general aviation in this country for years and years, and that it would cripple a system if you asked everyone to file an instrument flight plan. And so fairly soon thereafter, we were able to get VFR flights in the air, except, and this was a big exception that was very difficult, except in Class Bravo airspace. In other words, the Class B airspace around large metropolitan cities, there was no VFR allowed. Well, a majority of our flying in this country takes place in the large metropolitan areas, and Class B usually accompanies about 30 miles radius around large cities, so that didn't do much good for pilots in Southern California or any other place. I perfectly understood the situation in Washington, D.C., not necessarily agreeing with it in later years, but the biggest thing was, what about areas like Denver or Salt Lake City or San Francisco, where there was a lot of GA activity, VFR, and you couldn't fly there unless you had an instrument flight plan and an instrument rating? It was an interesting little survey we took to try to prove our point, because the FAA came back and said, well, half of the pilots in general aviation are instrument rated. And I said, well, they may be, but we did a survey and found that of those pilots that were instrument rated, that 50%, only one out of three were instrument current. So they really were grounding a lot of pilots, and you couldn't just turn, if you didn't have instrument currency, and turn around and file a flight plan legally. That was the thing that took probably almost, as I recall, 13 weeks or so before we were able to get that restriction released. And it was absurd the way the rule was written, because I remember a student pilot within Class B could solo and fly solo training flights, either the solo cross country or just solo in the pattern. But if they were a private pilot, they could not fly the plane. And so there was an interesting example, I think it was in the Pacific Northwest in the Seattle area, where a pilot took an airplane under his instructor's sign-off to an airport about 40 miles away where he took his check ride. Now, student pilots signed off by the instructor could make that 40-mile flight. With flying colors, he passed his check ride, only to find out he couldn't fly the very plane he brought there back, because now he was a private pilot. So they actually had to put two instructors in another plane, send them up there, and come back with them and call it a training flight coming back. So this was some of the absurdity. But finally, the sanity came into being there. That was kind of the pilot side, and I think today, of course, we're, you know, new pilots. They know nothing but the rules that govern their licensing, et cetera. But the other side of the coin that you asked, Mary, was airports. And this was really another case of all of a sudden people beginning to understand that our system in this country is not made up of airports with huge fences around every single one of them, or the very fact that every airport doesn't have a control tower and there's controlled flight, that a majority of our airports are unfenced, small airports in which planes that are of not much throw weight, so they couldn't do much damage, fly from. And all of a sudden, within about 30 days of 9/11, we realized that, wow, all of a sudden people are going to come down on airports. And I think to the call was, well, we're going to fence every airport, security fencing at every airport, security gates, and all these other things. And so it was at that time we thought, well, let's, instead of being reactive, while they're working on airline passenger screening and airport security at the large airports, let's be positive and proactive. And gee, it was just yesterday I saw a picture of somebody showing me a gate at their airport in Charlotte, North Carolina, where we all now see the black and yellow signs that AOPA was key to starting a program called Airport Watch. And it was I know I met with then, they had appointed, finally there was no TSA, but then they appointed the first administrator of the TSA, and I camped on his doorstep and I said, listen, here's what's coming next. Congress is probably going to be holding hearings. You're going to be asked, what are you doing about general aviation security? And here is a possible solution. And I got to tell you, it was Admiral James Loy, I think the second TSA administrator, who within 24 hours got back to me and was just taken by the idea. And I asked the TSA, could you give us an 800 number that would be answered live 24/7, and Admiral Lloyd did that, and we launched what is probably a program that succeeds today because it makes common sense. It says every airport can't be fenced in, and just lets you use the residents around it. And so my AOPA is very, very proud of being a part of the solution, rather than bad-mouthing solutions that often the government bureaucrats might come up with.
Well, it's a good point that I guess a lot of what had to be done was just educating these bureaucrats about what GA is and how things work. And I'm wondering if you looked at general aviation today, 10 years later, compared to 10 years ago, do you think we've managed to retain a lot of our freedoms, or how do you see the picture now as compared to what it was back then?
Well, remember, my perspective is one from, I saw how bad it could be back then. And we didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to alarm AOPA members and pilots throughout the country on some of the draconian things that could have happened. So I would have to answer, as somebody who flew 30 years pre-9/11/01 and who's flown some 10 years since, that it certainly isn't the same. But, you know, materially, it isn't that restrictive. And I think many pilots would endorse that. You know, if you're really wedded in the past, you were mad at Class B airspace far before 9/11. You were unhappy about TCAs before 9/11. You were unhappy about towered airports or, you know, those kinds of things. So this is just another in the progression of our transportation system. And while it is a little bit inconvenient, it's nationwide. I just shudder to think of what it could be or could have been. And it's still today possible, as I do from a non-powered airport where I'm based, it's possible for me to fly to many places in this country and not have to worry about a flight plan if the weather is good, not have to talk to anybody if I don't need to, and to have many of the freedoms we had to back in aviation in the past. Overall, Mary, I think it may be slightly inconvenient, but certainly we a great number of the majority of all the freedom that we had in the past.
Okay, well, thank you, Phil. I appreciate your taking the time to look back on what happened and where we are now, and I hope you're enjoying your retirement out there on the airpark in Ohio.
Thank you very much, Mary.
This podcast has been brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine. For more on aviation safety, log on to www.aviationsafetymagazine.com.